Mohamed El-Erian graciously joins me now to help us understand and get some needed perspective about the implications of the Brexit referendum. Mohamed is a Bloomberg View columnist, chief economic advisor at Allianz, and is chairman of President Obama's Global Development Council. In my previous interview last February, Mohamed and I discussed his latest book, The Only Game in Town, Central Banks, Instability, and Avoiding the Next Collapse, which can be heard at onthemoneyradio.org. Welcome back to the show, Mohamed.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on.
So, Mohamed, can you take a moment to simply and succinctly explain British citizens' vote to leave the EU and what it will entail in order to accomplish it?
So for 40 years, Britain has been a member of the European Union. It got free access to markets in Europe, in 27 other countries. But against that, it had to agree to implement certain regulations that were agreed to in Brussels. What the voters decided is they no longer like that equation. And a small majority of voters decided that what they would rather have is an exit from the European Union.
Yeah, this equation you spoke about is a give and take. They get free access and they have to then accept certain principles. One of those principles had to do with immigration, correct?
Correct. Free access of people, not just of goods and services, but also people. And that issue ended up being the defining issue in the referendum. So rather than assess the case on a comprehensive basis, it was a single issue at the end of the day that was the decision maker.
These referendums are quite dangerous. I guess from your writings, I understand that this was a political gambit by the current prime minister to try to appease some of the extreme members of his own party and without really understanding what risks were involved. What happened there?
So going into the last general election, Prime Minister Cameron had the same situation the Republican Party had in 2010, and that is the emergence of a fringe party, the Tea Party here, but over there it was UKIP, the United Kingdom Independence Party, and they were seeking an exit from the European Union. In order to secure his base, the Prime Minister said, if you re-elect me, and if I stay in government, I will hold a referendum. But before I hold the referendum, I will get certain concessions from my European partners. It was a gamble. It worked in the short term in that he was returned to office with a major majority. But then the concession that he got did not seem enough to appease those who felt that Brexit should occur. And when the referendum was held, through a series of silly mistakes, they found themselves playing defense and ended up losing the referendum. So the Prime Minister, in fact, had to resign the day after the referendum.
It was a question of misunderstanding and underestimating, I guess, the opposition and not taking it as seriously as needed. Is that correct assessment?
It was the same mistake as has been made repeatedly, including in this country, which is to underestimate the trust deficit between the majority of the people on the one hand and the political business elites, as well as expert opinion. So once again, just like happened with Donald Trump here, just like it has happened with non-traditional parties in Europe, the anti-establishment parties, expert opinion and the elites are underestimated the amount of anger that there is. And it's not surprising because we have been in this new normal of very low growth and worsening inequality.
Well, you discuss that in your latest book, The Only Game in Town. And in that book, you discussed three stages of central bank intervention. The first phase was do whatever it takes. The second phase was experiment with new tools in order to get the economy expanding, all the while letting the markets know that this is an experiment which has plenty of risks along with it. The third phase was to try to extricate the central bank from the process. Is Brexit one of these unforeseen risks you wrote about?
Yes, Brexit is yet another improbable and unthinkable that has turned into reality. Others include, for example, negative interest rates on 30% of global government debt. Think about that.
Yeah.
You lend your money to the government and you pay them for the privilege of you lending your money to them. You and I know that that is absurd, but that is what happens when you experiment for a long time, and when you do not promote economic growth. And I think Brexit is another example, and we're going to see lots of other improbables become reality if our politicians do not step up to their economic responsibilities.
Negative interest rates is so extreme, but not too long ago, really the other day, the 20-year yield on the German bond or Bund, so you lending your money to Germany for 20 years, was zero. What kind of a world would anybody lend money to any institution or person at zero rate?
So you and I find it very strange, and yet lots of people do it. And I think there are three reasons why they do it. One is they have to. They have certain regulation that forces them to hold safe government bonds. That's certainly the case for insurance companies and for banks. Two, they think that even though they're going to earn zero, that's much better than anywhere else. In particular, they're worried about elevated asset prices elsewhere. So they'd rather earn zero and secure their capital than lose their capital elsewhere. And the third reason is that they believe zero is not the end. They believe it's going to go more negative. And bonds have this feature that the more negative the interest rate goes, the higher the price. So you have three types of forces that are sustaining a world that looks very strange and certainly was not something that anybody expected just 18 months ago.
So what happens over the next few weeks and months?
So over the next few weeks in Britain, we are going to have political trauma. The Conservative Party is going to somehow have to reunite, elect a new leader. The Labour Party is putting enormous pressure on its own leader to exit. Scotland and Northern Ireland do not like the outcome of this referendum. So they are talking about perhaps independence from the rest of the United Kingdom. So it's a very messy situation. And in all this, somehow the UK has to negotiate a new arrangement. Now, there's some people who say maybe we can reverse Brexit. Maybe there's some parliamentary way that we can reverse Brexit or even hold a second referendum. Mm-hmm. The bottom line is it's incredibly fluid, and we should expect lots of day-to-day developments because there is no script for this.
There was a recent article in the Wall Street Journal describing the similarities between today's political upheaval and the 1930s. Now, the 1930s was caused by the Great Depression. The situation was much more dire then, and yet the political turmoil is so much similar. I mean, really, why do you think the level of discontent is so high? It's not as if we're in a deep depression worldwide.
And we discussed this back in February when you kindly interviewed me on my book. You remember the thesis of the book that we were on what the British call a T-junction. Think of you driving to a road and you're coming to an intersection. What you know for sure is that the road you're on is going to end. But there are two ways out that look dramatically different. The road we are on is ending. We cannot run sophisticated market democracies at very low growth rates and worsening inequality without something breaking. And what we are seeing, negative interest rates, Brexit, anti-establishment movements, these are all signs that the path we're on is ending. That is, I think, now more and more obvious to people. The problem is, or the hope, depending on whether you're an optimist or pessimist, is that there's nothing predestined about what comes next. It depends on political choices. There is one scenario in which low growth gives way to high inclusive growth, but there's another scenario, and that is if the political system doesn't step up, where low growth becomes recession, artificial financial stability becomes instability, income inequality worsens even more, and political breakage accelerates. So we are heading towards that T-junction, and a lot will depend on the choices made in the next months and quarters.
Are these institutions flexible enough to change with actual real conditions on the ground?
That's a great question. Let me tell you, it's not an engineering question. Most economists, in fact, the vast majority of economists, agree on the four things that need to happen for us to get out of this mediocre world of low growth. So it's not an engineering problem. It is really a political will problem. It's the ability to implement. And you require what's called the Sputnik moment. You require a recognition by the nation that unless we do something now, we will face something very nasty down the road. It happened in the late 50s when the U.S. woke up to the reality that the Soviet Union, the USSR, or what Ronald Reagan subsequently called the evil empire, had succeeded in sending a satellite into space and national security was threatened. The nation came together and responded in a very effective way. And what we need today is an economic Sputnik moment.
Well, the EU is an outgrowth of many Sputnik moments based upon all of the turmoil, wars, poverty, and misery caused by two world wars and many wars in the 19th century and so on. And it has really, in a positive side, the creation of the EU has created a stable, peaceful Europe for the first time in really a millennia, I suppose. I guess that's just not enough at this point. You know, and so what do you think this Sputnik moment's going to turn out to be? Any ideas?
So the EU's biggest problem was that there was an inconsistency from day one when the UK joined, and that inconsistency never went away. The UK viewed the EU as a destination. It was a super free trade zone, and that's why the UK was interested. The rest of Europe, and particularly Germany and France, viewed the EU as a means to an end, and that end is ever closer union, yes. Economic, financial, social, and political. And that was a fundamental difference in views. The hope had been that there would be convergence. As it turned out, there wasn't sufficient convergence. So there was an initial problem, an original sin, if you like, when the UK joined the EU that was never solved. In terms of what you need, it's not that hard. I mean, that's what's so frustrating. It's not that hard. Basically, it requires coherent politics. It requires the courage by Congress in particular to take steps in which individual parties come together in the interest of the nation, recognizing that their base, either the more progressive side of the Democratic Party or on the other side, the Tea Party side of the Republican Party, may object, but ultimately governing from the middle is what's required right now in the United States.
Some brilliant uniter has to rise from the ashes, a Churchillian-like figure, in order to bring all of these together. My guest is Mohammed El-Arian. He's graciously joined me today to discuss the Brexit referendum and its implications. Mohammed, investment-wise, you know, all of these ideas we speak about are really not in our control as individual citizens. So let's talk about some of the things that could be in our control. So investment-wise, we know that this crisis will produce opportunities. So what are some of the areas in the marketplace that we should be looking to tap into?
A shock like Brexit, which changes the structure of trade and raises more questions than answers, is the equivalent of what markets call unusual uncertainty. It's not just uncertainty, it's unusual uncertainty. That means volatility goes up. And when volatility goes up, you get what's called contagion, which means good names and bad names behave the same for a while. Why? Because you've suddenly put so many things in play that investors cannot immediately differentiate. There are technical factors that lead to this. So if you happen to be an investor with dry powder, with cash, this is a wonderful time to pick up good names that are trading cheaply. And the way you find good names, whether they are companies or whether they are countries, is three characteristics: very strong balance sheets, positive cash flow, and good management. Those are the three characteristics. And immediately after Brexit, you saw companies with these three characteristics being beaten up and offering opportunities for investors. And I suspect that this is going to be a repeated pattern in the months to come.
Most investors over the last few years have been counseled, educated to move much of their money into what are known as passive investments or broad-based index funds. Is that an idea that should still be considered the best idea? Or in the new world you're describing, is it more important to be more discerning and try to separate out the good from the bad?
It depends where you're investing. So what do you get with passive funds? First, you get low fees. And in a world in which expected returns are low, if you can minimize your fees, that's a good thing. And second, you don't have to worry about manager selection. You know, in order to do well in active management, you have to get the top 50% or preferably the top 25% of managers. Not everybody can be in the top 25%. That's obvious. So you have to be able to select managers well. Passive funds get you out of this dilemma if you're not confident about that. However, passive funds make you invest in names, not because they're good, but because they're part of the index. That is particularly dangerous in certain asset classes. So in emerging markets in particular, let me give you an example. If you are investing in the bonds issued by emerging markets, the weight in the index is based on how many bonds the country has issued. The more bonds the country issues, the more indebted it becomes. The more indebted it becomes, the higher the risk of default. So you don't want to be investing in a name simply because it's acting irresponsibly in issuing more debt. Right. And as a reminder, on the eve of Argentina defaulting in 2001, it was 22% of the index.
Yeah.
So one has to be selective as to how they use passive and how they use active management.
Be selective is the message. Mohammed, we're out of time. Thank you so much for graciously joining our show to help educate and protect our investors from this quite uncertain world. My guest, Mohammed El-Aryan, Chairman of President Obama's Global Development Council, Economic Advisor at Allianz. Mohammed, once again, thank you so much.
My great pleasure. Thank you.